This is a Rant Entertainment Media special presentation.
What's up, true believers? Tonight we bring you a very special What Are You Reading comic book show / talk brunch collaboration, or as we comic book fans like to call it, a podcast team up. Tonight, the Surfer himself and Jordan Cobb from the What Are You Reading comic book show, as well as Mick Wrestling and myself, Rick Dara from the Talk Brunch podcast, are going to be talking with you about the new Netflix original Marvel series, Jessica Jones. How are you doing tonight, gentlemen?
I'm doing great as usual.
Yeah, fantastic. All systems go here. Everything looking good.
Yeah.
Overall, what do you guys think of the series?
Overall, having already been through the entire season, I think it's an incredible show that is rich in great neo-noirism, which, by the way, noir being possibly my favorite genre ever of anything, and it's filled with complexly written characters, beautifully acted, wonderfully directed. It's fucking incredible.
Yeah, agreed. Definitely agreed.
I'm definitely going to agree with him, too. I'm only up to episode 3, and I'm loving it. Jessica Jones is a character. I've never actually really followed her books. So to see it as a casual fan, it's a cool experience for me.
Yeah, and just to let you listeners know, we're going to go around and we're going to discuss what episodes we're up to and everything. But the first half of this is spoiler-free. We'll give you a warning before we go into spoilers. We're going to be reviewing episodes 1, 2, and 3 in this specific episode, and then we'll take it from there. So, Mick Wrestling, you mentioned you've seen the first 3 episodes?
Yes.
Oh, and Jordan seen the entire series. And what about you, Surfer?
I've seen about 4 episodes so far. And I'm fascinated by the story they're telling. This is something I've not seen when it comes to comic book television.
Yeah.
I think it's easy for them to do the superhero genre. Or even do, like, when they do
like Flash or Arrow or something like that?
Yeah, that's superhero. But when they starting to do, you know, like Doctor Strange, that'll be a little different from what we're used to. Or,
yeah.
It's a little bit more gritty and dark.
And what we saw in Guardians of the Galaxy, which was, you know, space opera-ish. This seems, even though, like Daredevil, this seems grounded, but this seems less like a superhero and more like an everyday situation going on, except for the characters just happen to have superpowers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Here's my thing overall of the show. While and again, this is based off mainly the Alias comic book, which is the huge like self Jessica Jones comics where she got her start, debuted, and whatnot. While it takes a bit of a different direction in its overall story, and I'll just say that, it takes a bit of a different, slightly different direction, it's still very much a faithful, true adaptation and tone in the sense of its tone, its style, and how true it keeps the characters. Because here, everybody feels like how they are from almost everybody. Because again, there are some different characters, and we'll get into that later, in particular with Carrie Ann Moss, but again, everyone feels like how they should. Everyone fits their role perfectly. I found this to be quite an experience to just go right through and see every episode together. It's truly fantastic.
This is based off the Alias comic book that was written by Brian Michael Bendis. When did this come out? Like 2001?
Yeah, Alias, which was written by Brian Michael Bendis and drawn by Michael Gaddos. Was published from November 2001 to January 2004 and ran on the Marvel Max line, which was their attempt at a Vertigo sort of thing that DC has.
More of an adult line of comics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Except they kind of kept it a little, except they were willing to let it be a little bit more tied towards their main universe. Ran from November 2001 to January 2004 for 28 issues.
Now, the character Jessica Jones was created because actually Bendis wanted to do Jessica Drew, who used to be at the time Spider-Woman. and she had lost her powers. And I guess Marvel didn't allow him to use that character, so he created Jessica Jones, and they retconned her into the Marvel Universe, where she apparently went to high school with Peter Parker.
Yeah, and she was given this entire backstory.
She had a crush on him.
She used to go to high school. Peter Parker had a bit of a crush on him. And when her family was coming back from a trip at Disney World, they had and her dad, who got the tickets to go to Disney World thanks to his boss, Tony Stark, were involved in an unfortunate accident with a toxic waste truck, which then gave Jessica Jones her superpowers.
Exactly. And overall, this has a darker tone than anything that Marvel's done at this point. It definitely honors that in a lot of ways. I've been addicted. I've seen 7 episodes. I'm up to episode 8 so far.
This is darker than Daredevil. And I'll say this, as someone who Daredevil's my favorite Marvel comic book character overall, this is way darker than Daredevil.
I was going to ask that, if you guys find it to be darker than Daredevil.
It's way darker than Daredevil. 10. It is.
I'm more interested. Like, I didn't watch it just because I wanted to marathon it. I just felt compelled to keep going. It just got better and better.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, well, my only weak episode, I would say, is episode 3, but we're going to get into my reasoning behind that. Like, episode 3, I wasn't really feeling at all.
Yeah, that's why I left off. I liked it. I have no complaints.
I loved the episode.
Yeah, just a few weird things, but we'll get into that when we get to our spoilery section of this. But overall, yeah, I like this a lot. I like the tone of it. I like the entire color of the atmosphere. I like the fact that in the Daredevil series, they chose to go with a color scheme of everything having like that red that he has to it. But now we're like in a part of the city where it's everything sort of like a purple lavender.
Yeah.
You know, they seem to change that with the mood.
Well, Daredevil was also feeling the noir feeling because of what it was getting based on, from mainly the Frank Miller, Brian Michael Bendis, and Ed Brubaker runs of those. Whereas this is more heavily based off the one singular Brian Michael Bendis comic book. And again, both those have a noir setting, but Jessica Jones is more of the noir show. Jessica Jones is more of a noir, really more so, if you want to get technical, neo-noir sort of thing. God, my film nerd is showing. but Daredevil was really more of a straight crime drama with a superhero in it. This is more of a noir drama with a superhero in it. And both work in their own regards. They're incredible. But we're going to talk about Jessica Jones, which is a fantastic fucking show.
Now, I will say, with Daredevil, you got the sense that the atmosphere of the street was very crime ridden, very dangerous. You know, when you step outside, you wasn't sure if you was taking your life in your hands.
It was real New York. It's not movie like Hollywood glamorized New York.
Now, this doesn't show that side of New York. Like, it's like you don't feel like everyone's in danger or somebody's going to die from ordinary crime in this particular series, but you do feel that surrounding the main character, there's a lot of danger and dread.
Mm-hmm. And they went out of their way to make it feel very gritty. Everyone's very dirty. I don't want to say filthy, but you know, it has like that gritty New York alleyway dark style to it, you know, in a sense where there's needles and shit and drugs and addiction and
prostitution rings, you know, because again, like the opening thing with Daredevil is like he's stopping a bunch of girls from being shoved in the container, being like, because they're obviously part of human trafficking. But
what's funny about these series is it almost feels as if like they aren't part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe when you think of Guardians and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and stuff.
Yeah,
you know that they are,
which isn't a bad thing.
I think they do a good job of making it feel like this is still all connected, even though they, you know, they've been giving us different tones with different projects. I mean, they're still mentioning, you know, the Avengers.
Oh, yeah, they referenced them several times.
The alien attack and whatnot.
So we know this is all one universe.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's
and it shows why these people are taking care of the big stuff over here. You got these people taking care of the little stuff in this corner and making sure.
Yeah, I mean, It does a great, both of these shows do a great job of feeling, of being separate unto themselves, but also feeling nicely connected.
Exactly. And without going into too much spoilers, there's an episode, we won't be going into it today, but there was an episode that the whole time you're thinking that this episode is following the main plot, only to find out that it was actually more connected to what happened in the Avengers and the Marvel Cinematic Universe at the end.
I think I know what you're talking about, but I'm not going to say that right now.
And it was a really cool episode. I remember thinking, how funny that here I'm still in Jessica Jones mode, and they just brought something back from Avengers, and it was like, oh, cool. So yeah. I like that those little Easter eggs, so many Easter eggs, more than I've seen in anything.
I can bring up some of those Easter eggs, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, of course. Oh, no, I was just going to say, overall, I'm glad about certain changes. I'm glad that they just call him Kilgrave and not Zebediah.
Okay, some name, yeah, let's all be pretty fair. Okay, look, Zebediah is a bit of an intimidating name because in some regards, but yeah, just having the word Kilgrave allows it for so much as to be like, because even the jokes that Jessica Jones and others make about it is wonderful.
But the name Kilgrave does sound like that's a...
Well, that's also, yeah.
And they don't call him the Purple Man either. They never refer to him as the Purple Man.
That's also the Purple Man's actual last name, because his full name from the comics is Zebediah Kilgrave.
Right. Well, it is, but I'm just glad that they don't bring up the Zebediah.
Now, the lead character in this, Jessica Jones, is played by Christian Ritter.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and I wasn't sure if she was going to be the right person for this when they first announced that she was cast, because she is like she's like a thin person, and you wouldn't think maybe she would be right for the role, but she's playing this role to a T. I mean,
a lot of people say the same thing about Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman.
We'll find out about that too. But
I'm included in those people, by the way.
I bought into her being this character, Jessica Jones. You know, like I do believe she has these abilities, and they're going over the top too. Like apparently, what she can do is she hasn't picked up a car or anything, but and thrown it across the street. But she's done stuff that lets you know she does have abilities that the average person does not have.
Well, and they showed in a believable way.
They do, but one thing, I can't give it a perfect because that's what we're here for, us to review. I find it a little inconsistent. Like, I find certain scenes where she's able to kick someone through a wall, and then in another scene, someone will grab her and choke her for a while, or maybe she'll get tased a little bit and not be able to get up, you know,
well, my suspension of disbelief. Hey, even the Hulk can get fooled sometimes. But
how fooled can you fool the Hulk? You know what I mean? When you look at it like that, there are times she seems really unstoppable, and then other times where it's just inconsistent. Like, yeah, when she pats someone in a sleeper hold, and she's like
that's what me and full screenwriters like to call plot convenience.
Very convenient plot. We'll get into that, though. We will. But like, there was one point where she put a sleeper hold on someone, and she's struggling to get the person to go to sleep. And I'm thinking, Dolph Ziggler's sleeper hold would have lasted longer on this. Like, what the fuck are you doing? Aren't you Jessica Jones?
Well, again, here's the thing with Jessica Jones. She's trying not to kill the guy.
Maybe that was Spider-Man.
Okay, there's that, but there's another scene when she's with Luke Cage, and they're making love. And she's grabbing onto the wall.
Oh, no, they are fucking.
They're fucking.
They're hardcore.
Okay, all right.
Fucking.
So they're hardcore fucking. The camera pans to her hand grabbing on the paneling of the wall. And I was expecting to see some effects of her, like with her gripping the wall, that she was going to like break the base or something. But nothing happened there.
Well, yeah, I think she's pulling a Spider-Man where she's pulling what she can actually do. Looks like she's holding back.
Yeah, but you can't hold back an ass whipping. There's times that I've seen people whipping her ass. Like, I'm a little further, so I won't spoil things, but there's a few times where I've seen people where it's kind of like, you shouldn't be able to, it's one thing to be restraining and pulling back punches, like someone like Superman would do that or whatever, but you're like basically just taking an ass beating.
Well, here's the other thing I feel like with the scene you're talking about where they're just straight up fucking. Here's the thing. I feel like that's also a great reason as to why I like that particular scene in the comic, because look, she's not looking to dominate, because when she's with Luke Cage, when she's in bed with Luke Cage, she was doing what she was doing to primarily feel something. Because again, by this point, she is still so broken inside. Like, her only solace is whiskey and whatnot. She was looking to feel something. And really, Luke Cage, when he's giving it to her, it's making her feel something, like, deep down, which is why the implication of anal sex, both in the panel of the comic and especially, even in the scene of the show that happened, she was looking to feel something because she's not looking to give, she's wanting.
Okay. We know, we can tell this character is broken inside, and we are finding out what broke her, what
slowly.
Yeah.
I keep hearing it referred to as anal sex, though. Is that like a confirmed thing? Because I just took it as doggy style when I saw the scene.
That's
the guy. Well, in the comic, it's heavily implied that, because one of the panels is a very close up of her strained face. Because again, the narration boxes even imply that, look, she's not doing this to do something. She's doing it to feel something. Because again, she's still like feeling horrible inside and whatnot.
Right.
She's trying to feel something. So it's implied.
It could just be that he's black and has a big dick.
Well, one of the captions says she let him do anything. And often more not in pop culture, that also means butt stuff. So that's a clear implication. It's a dick and ass.
I mean, nowadays, anything could really be anything. You got to be careful when you say that would be limited
well,
to
butt
stuff.
That is true as well.
She let him reenact Two Girls, One Cup.
God, oh, come on, no.
hey, here's my friend Carol Danvers. You want to see us do some sick shit?
Where is this going?
God damn it, I've ruined the Alias comic for myself, you assholes. I'm a horrible person.
I think
it's kind of funny to get that comfortable with that kind of an act. Not that there's anything wrong. I ain't judging anyone here, but I'm just saying it's kind of weird to get that comfortable with an act on like a, I guess like a first time hookup, like literally, like a bar time hookup.
Well, with a character like Jessica Jones, she was like, fuck it. God damn it.
Yeah, I'm an ass man.
It was just there. It just had to be done, you know?
Yeah. No, I'd be upset if you didn't do it.
You know what? I waited for you to bring up the scene on purpose, though, Jordan, because I was wondering, because I've been hearing on YouTube and a lot of places all throughout the week about the anal sex scene, and I kept thinking to me it was the doggy style scene. So I wanted to know if you thought of it at the anal sex scene or
that was presented like the very first pages of the comic in the first issue, and it was being done doggy style.
Yeah, of course. So now I guess if we're going by the comic canon, then yeah. We spent a lot of time on that, but yeah, it was anal sex confirmed.
Yeah, Surfer, what did you want to bring up in regard?
I was about to say, I think it's left to your imagination that if you want to believe that's what happened, then that's what happened. And if not, then it's just, you know, a little backdoor action, doggy style, but not.
Right, right. But in the comic, it definitely happened, though, from, you know, especially from Jordan's description. Like, they made sure you knew what was happening, at least in that version.
Yeah. But there wasn't a panel close up of like Gonzo style like you see on Bang Bros or something.
I would hope not.
Oh, that's awesome.
No, there isn't. No, hey, Brian Michael Bendis likes to get very descriptive. He ain't that goddamn descriptive.
Exactly.
Thank God. Thank you.
Now, Mike Coulter was casted to play Luke Cage, and of course, he's the next Netflix. How do y'all like his portrayal of Luke Cage, a.k.a. Power Man?
For me personally, I'm blown away by him as Luke Cage more than I expected. There are some things that he's done, man, where it's just been like, this guy is awesome, like a really cool character. Like, there were a few fighting scenes he had and where it was just like, after they were done, I thought to myself, so when's that Luke Cage Netflix series original going to come out? I could use that right about now. Like, he is a dope character. If anyone's going to lay her, it's going to be him.
You know, I wasn't sure who they was going to get to play Luke Cage because you would hear certain names come up and you think that person can't play Luke Cage. I mean, they was talking about what's that singer's name for Fast and Furious?
Tyrese
Gibson. Tyrese,
yeah, he was.
Luke Cage?
Yeah. Okay, look, I like Tyrese fine, but I cannot see him as Luke Cage.
Me either.
No.
I know there was some actors that I thought could play Luke Cage. That
the obvious, you know, big choice everyone was saying, like Terry Crews.
Yeah, can you imagine if it was Tyrese? I got to stop you guys for a second before you go any further. Can you imagine if Tyrese would have been banging her?
I also think Tyrese would put way too much effort into Sweet Christmas.
And I got to give Marvel credit. They do get the casting of these characters right. You know, you may not think going in that they're the right person, but after you see them, you do buy into them being that. And yeah, I see this guy being a good Luke Cage, and for sure. I'm looking forward to his series. And now they gotta, let's see who they cast as Iron Fist, you know, make that work.
Yeah, I totally agree. To me, he looked a little bit small, but I can get past that. It's supposed to be somewhat realistic. And again, his acting is phenomenal. As I said before, I've not really read like the Iron Fist, Power Man, Jessica Jones series. I've only seen him in things like the animated Spider-Man cartoon. So, and it's like the stuff that I've played in video games, like the Marvel Ultimate Alliance titles. But in my mind, of what I've gathered of the character to be, he is the embodiment of that character. I have no gripes with him.
Fully agree. I think, now here's my thing. I had seen Mike Coulter before because I do watch CBS show The Good Wife.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm a 50-year-old woman at heart.
What is that? I don't even know what that is. I sound like Jason.
All right. He's primarily just been a recurring role, and I thought he's very good. So when I heard him, he was cast as Luke Cage, I thought, okay, well, I like him, so now I'll be able to get to see him do a little bit more. And again, to borrow the phrase from Luke Cage, Sweet Christmas is this guy great. I think he's a perfect fit for Luke Cage. He fits perfectly this role. He gets the charisma. He gets the like the sense of duty, sense of action, and whatnot, and more so the person that Luke Cage is, the good person at heart that someone Luke Cage is.
Someone who's willing to protect his own.
Exactly. Luke Cage is one of my absolute all-time favorite characters, as is Iron Fist, which makes me giddied as like, God, dude, just cast Iron Fist already so I can get Heroes for Hire, please.
Oh, it's fine.
But I'm already too excited right now. Don't make me get it even more excited. But
yeah, what do you want to go change your undies real quick?
Not right now. But hey, Heroes for Hire does that to me. But anyway, look, Mike Coulter's Luke Cage is a fantastic performance. The sensitivity of doing of protecting people and whatnot, looking out for his own, he gets that, and it's absolutely amazing.
He's a convincing badass. He's a very convincing badass, and what definitely
helps.
Yeah, and what definitely helps with him is that as I'm getting to the second half of the series, something that I'm noticing is that they kind of tease you with Luke Cage, like they sort of Tommy the Green Ranger him with you, you know, where it's like sort of like, he's not really directly involved to the point where you almost want him more involved than he is, where it's like you wish that he would like kick the purple man's ass, you know, but he's not directly involved in the main plot. He's left out of it for the most part.
Yes. Again, I absolutely love that. And especially there's one scene I think is about, a scene in the bar that involves Jessica and some patrons.
Right. Yeah, that was awesome.
That made me happy. It was like, yeah, this guy, that really, because again, I was already sold on him, but seeing him get into full action, I was like, dude, put the yellow shirt on him, give him the tiara, fuck yes.
Minus spoilers, like he gets the sunglasses.
Fighting, and then he looks to like Jessica, like when she's fighting off some of the guys too, just the expression on his face, like, wait, what the fuck? And it was like, wait,
at that point, I was like, Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, giver of no fucks. Just amazing.
Now that
Mike Coulter's Luke Cage is fantastic.
Now, what you were saying about them not being much in it, that probably is a good thing because we probably don't want him too overexposed before
he gets his own spinoff.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Having seen the whole thing, I will say Luke Cage is in this series just the right amount he needs to, because look, what they don't need, because again, he's more like, look, when we need your character for the narrative, we will call on you. And look,
it is a Jessica Jones series.
And look, when he's reintroduced in the second half and whatnot, when he's used correctly, it's at the exact right point the narrative would need Luke Cage back. So it's so again, they use Luke Cage here just to write him out, and they give you enough just to tease you right before. Because again, they're filming as we're recording this right now. They are still filming the Luke Cage season one.
Is it a prequel though, or is it going to take place after this? Like, we don't really know the
content, right? From what I've heard, it seems like it'll take place after this. Because again, this is not going also because this is also not going to be in Hell's Kitchen. And the Luke Cage series is going to deal more in Luke's neighborhood of Harlem,
right?
And all that, and deal with other people, you know, like Cottonmouth and Misty Knight and whatnot. But again.
Yeah, I'm hearing that Misty Knight's supposed to be cast in the Luke Cage.
Oh, she's series. Already casted. They've already casted right. her.
Right. So yeah. It was weird because it would make you think that it was possibly a prequel as opposed to a sequel to this, right?
No, it's taking place after.
It doesn't have to be a prequel because they're still friends, you know. It's not like they just meet and they could already know each other. So
you mean maybe she's not being cast like as if she's still Luke Cage's wife at the time?
They was married at one time?
I do not recall Luke Cage and Misty Knight being married, and I would fucking know.
I thought they were.
No, she's...
Oh.
She has a on and again, off again relationship with Iron Fist. She's never been with Luke
Cage. Yeah, it's...
Right,
yeah,
right, it was Iron Fist,
yeah,
okay.
It was more Misty and Danny, not Misty and Luke.
Okay.
Now, they do introduce other characters to this, like Trish Walker, played by Rachel Taylor.
Yes, a.k.a. Hellcat?
Well, yeah. Actually, she's Patsy Walker, who is related to a 50s character from...
Yeah.
She's going to be Hellcat. They're already teasing it because they just put Trish in front of Patsy Walker. But, you know, originally, that was supposed to be Carol Danvers.
Well, yes, because Carol Danvers in the Alias comic book is Jessica Jones's best friend and was the one that helped that recognized what was going on with her and helped her out and got protection and healthcare she needed under S.H.I.E.L.D. and the mental therapy with Jean Grey.
Right, and that was originally.
Do you think they changed that because of the so-called upcoming?
Movie? Oh yeah, they did.
That is why they did that.
Said, yeah, we they already said we were originally going to use Carol as it was intended, but they had bigger film plans with her, so we got to get creative.
Mm.
So they put Hellcat, which isn't a bad choice, and they've already shown signs.
Well, no, it
works.
Rachel Taylor as Triss Walker, aka as Triss Patsy Walker. It is a great fit. I think that is a great performance in itself and a good replacement. Because again, they already were going to have to get creative working around Jean Grey being involved and helping her come up with her mental blocks after breaking the spell with the Purple Man and whatnot. But then I heard like, oh shit, they can't use Carol. Well, who's going to be her like emotional anchor and whatnot? And I think they did a good job with finding a replacement.
Yeah, for sure. They absolutely did. And her origin story, I like that they rehashed it because they're not going to have it that the Avengers gave her an ass beating.
Yes. Again, it takes a slightly different story direction than the story of the comic, but kept faithful to it.
Yeah, and minor spoiler, but they do shout out her alter ego, Jewel. I know you saw that, Jordan.
Yes, and I was actually pretty pleased with that.
When they pulled out the costume, as soon as I saw it, I was thinking, holy shit, that's the Jewel costume. Like, there's no way they're going to put that on her.
Wait, they actually showed the costume?
Yes, she brought, Trish brought the costume out as a suggestion for her to wear and be named Jewel.
It's in a flashback sequence.
That's awesome. I can't wait to catch up to that.
Yeah, that was a really cool scene.
Yeah, you're not too, you're going to catch it pretty soon. So.
Okay, I know she mentions it to Luke at one point, and he was like, oh, you had a costume and everything? So,
Easter eggs all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, now the main antagonist, Kilgrave, a.k.a. the Purple Man, is played by David Tennant, who is known for playing Doctor Who.
Yes, mm-hmm. And is ruining so many fans' perceptions, and I am drinking up the fangirl tears. I love Tennant's Doctor Who as well, but my favorite tweet of this all has been someone posting, hey, that's a great crush you have on David Tennant. It'd be a shame if something were to happen to it. And here's the thing. Here's the thing I fully acknowledge about Kilgrave. He is a horrific, twisted, psychopathic monster. But goddamn, if his fashion game isn't always on point when he's on screen.
Now, what is his origin?
Okay. The original origin of Zebediah Kilgrave, as mentioned before, actual fucking name. He was a Croatian physician turned international spy who was sent to infiltrate a chemical refinery, but during the mission, he was accidentally doused with a chemical that turned his hair and skin purple, and there was a deeper side effect in that it also released pheromones that would allow him to verbally control the actions of others around him. So he could tell you, like, "Surfer, I want you to go stab yourself in the hand." You would then immediately be compelled to go and stab yourself in the hand.
Okay, and like, where did he make his origin? Like, what is he? Was he created for this book? No.
He debuted in Daredevil number 4 back in like October 64. He's mainly a Daredevil villain. And like the most recent thing they've done with the Purple Man is that he created an army of his bastard children. Like over the years, he had used women under his mind control powers and gotten them pregnant after making them fall in love with him and abandoned them and made them forget about it. So he collected all of them and created an army of purple children. But once they were all together, they were actually more powerful than him. And they overtook him and he had to go seek the help of Daredevil to be like, "I created an army of mind control children. I screwed up, man. You got to help me."
And his powers don't really work on Daredevil, correct?
No, not really. Because again, it's like, yeah, if I can't see what I'm doing, whatnot. But
it's a perception
Jessica,
thing.
But his relation to Jessica Jones is very much still true. He is very much responsible for who Jessica Jones becomes. Her reason as to why she was only briefly a superhero, and as to why she leaves the life behind and becomes the self-destructive mess that we see her at the beginning of the Alias comic book and at the beginning of this TV show.
Okay, now the other major characters for the series is
we get a little bit of L Word, a little bit of the L Word in this series, huh?
Okay.
We got Carrie Ann Moss as Jerry Hogarth, who is a completely different version than Jaren Hogarth.
Hashtag gender swap.
No, very much. Again, Jaren Hogarth is the attorney to Danny Rand, a.k.a. Iron Fist. But here is played by Carrie Ann Moss, and she is Jerry Hogarth, a very, very successful, powerful attorney who makes no qualms. Yeah, I'm a bitch. Whatever.
So she could tie into that series too.
Yes, she very much could. And after seeing what they do with her character, I'm very interested in how she ties into Iron Fist.
Yeah, this is Carrie Ann Moss's first run into anything comic bookish. Like, Matrix doesn't count, but she's not.
Yeah, and she's great here.
She's good in the role. She's very good in the role.
Oh, she's amazing.
It's funny how they have that whole thing as a side story, like her whole divorce and the affair and everything is just like this little side thing that's going on that gets really
crazy.
That's
amazing.
She shows, her character isn't like, she's more the greatest character of this whole series. It's like this, there are things about her that you could like about her, but there are things about her that you could make you despise her.
What I love about her storyline is that, again, it's a completely wholly layered story in of itself. And it's fascinating in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So like you said, she's a great character, but she has a storyline that you're interested in.
Yes. One other character from the comics that's here.
And who's that?
Will Simpson.
And who's he?
Will Simpson is the Daredevil slash Captain America villain Nuke.
Oh, Nuke, okay.
Yeah, where is he in this?
You never heard of Nuke?
Yeah.
No, but I mean, where is he in the show?
Oh, he appears about do you remember the cop that Kilgrave tells to walk off to, you know, walk go and yes. walk off the ledge?
Yeah, I know what cop you're talking about.
That's him.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
I knew he was a comic character. I know he was that comic character.
No, you will very much see that later on.
Awesome. Awesome.
So we also have Malcolm played by, Eco Darville, and Aaron Moriarty. Did I say that right?
Aaron Moriarty.
Yeah, she is Hope Slotsman, who's one of the catalysts of the storyline going on.
She kicks off the show, really.
Is there anything else you want to?
No, I really think that was about it. I just wanted to say overall, we're about to get into the spoiler section. You know, so if you haven't watched at least the first three episodes, stop this, go watch those, come back. You know, we don't want to screw this up. It's definitely not something that you want spoiled.
No,
Few last things I wanted to say about the series. It was originally going to be sold to ABC. Thankfully not.
This has been a development in a while with the same career. She wanted to get this. This was originally going to be done around 2010 with the working title, aka Jessica Jones, since ABC was like, well, we already had a show called Alias. So, you know, but it was intended to air in 2011. But then, hey, guess what? A whole bunch of rights came back to Marvel. They realized, oh, we could kind of work this in and whatnot. And they held off until it was like, all right, we're going to do it.
I'm glad that they did. And I'm seeing a lot of pieces come into place. If they want to, we can have a very solid Defender series in the future.
Yeah, I think so. I think, and of course, we got part two of Daredevil coming up.
In the spring.
So.
Sorry, too excited. Again, that's my favorite Marvel character, damn it.
That was a great laugh for you. His laugh of joy. I need to make that into my message.
That was giddiness, is what you heard.
Yeah, so we're going to go with the first three episodes. So
all right, spoiler tag, get out of here.
But we want you to come back once you've had a chance to view these episodes yourself. So, and to see if you agree or disagree with what we're saying.
Yeah.
You know.
All right. So I'm going to count us down. It's just spoilers. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Spoiler time!
All right. Episode 1.
Yeah, a.k.a. Ladies' Night.
In this episode, we start off seeing Jessica Jones explain what her situation is, that she's a private investigator. She basically hired to follow cheating men and or discover what dirty secrets people have hiding. And through her ability, she's good at seeking these things out. And it's usually a situation where when she goes back to her clients, they don't like what she has to say, which allows her to get in situations she has to defend herself. And you see right away that she's a pretty badass because she throws a client through a door because they're not too happy at what she's telling them about.
He finds out the wife or the girlfriend's cheating on him with his own brother.
That was Alias comic book Easter egg there, right? The face through the glass door?
I believe so, yeah. At some point, that does happen in the comic. Not like right away in Alias, but there does become an unruly customer just because it's like, okay, fine, you're going through the door.
And it gives you the feel that life fucking sucks.
That
it's cool. You know, you're not getting a campy story with a happy ending all the time.
Yeah, no. I feel like that opening, along with the title credits, really help to set up the noir, the setting of the show.
Atmosphere.
She's very restless. She's she drinks a lot to try to kill all the stuff she's feeling inside.
Because she's still reeling with PTSD from her
experience with Kilgrave.
Yeah, exactly.
And slowly they start to hint at, you know, what's really gnawing her on the inside. Now, you find that she has an obsession with one Luke Cage. She goes out and she's stalking him in a way, you know, but she's acting like it's a job where she's investigating him as to who he's dealing with as far as women goes. But yeah, it's all a ruse. She's just stalking the guy because she fancies him in a way. And there's more to it that we'll find out later as to why she's stalking this particular person.
Yeah, one of the methods that we see of the stalking that she's doing, which is important later on, is we see her spying from the fire escape of one of the apartments across the street from him with binoculars.
Yeah, yeah, at Josie's bar, which is the same bar that, you know, Matt and Foggy like to frequent from Daredevil. But here's the thing. It's more of a... Well, that's more of a, traditional noir sort of thing for a gumshoe, you know, detective or whatnot. To be more like, okay, this I got the best vantage point. You know, you got to take pictures for the job and whatnot. But that's also how she's like, you're not using your job skills very well. That's stalkerish. That's creepy. although if Christian Ritter wanted to look at me through my bedroom window, I'm certainly not going to object to that at first.
Well, at first, we don't really realize what we get the impression that she might be doing it as a private investigator.
That she's actually doing her job.
Right. Yeah.
And like when she wakes up the next morning, you know, it's like, oh, I got to go through another day. And she discovers her neighbor in his in her apartment because he's
a junkie.
And
he's asleep against the refrigerator.
Well, right.
He's a junkie.
Yeah. He's eating her peanut butter.
And then some clients show up and the client's name is Bob and Barbara Schlotman. Is this Schlotman? Am I saying this right?
Schlotman.
And they say, well, you were referred to us. We're looking for our daughter. We haven't heard from her in a while. She just dropped off the face of the earth and we're worried about her. We came in from Oklahoma. Could you help us?
Yeah. And soon as Jessica goes along with the investigation, she's discovering a pattern that is all too similar to when she was first under the influence of Kilgrave, which is what leads to her finding Hope, being ordered to just lie there and look at the clock by Kilgrave, be like, just lie there, look at the clock, count how many hours are there, and then he just leaves because that's how he gets to you. That's his own sick, twisted form of psychological torture.
Now, the Kilgrave character, she's not sure this person is alive because she, to her knowledge, he's dead.
Last she saw him, he got hit by the bus.
Yeah, but she is having PTSD attacks throughout this because
the PTSD, PTSD, PTSD. God damn it!
Yeah, we all screwed it up. Don't worry. The PTSD.
That is leading her. That she willingly acknowledges. Yeah, I'm not handling shit well, but fuck it. That's an inherent trait of the character and what, you know, in her overall arc. And it's like, I realize this is what I'm doing, but this is the only way I can somewhat feel something again and whatnot, how I can feel human.
How she's coping with it.
Exactly.
And just a couple of things I wanted to comb back over a little bit was in the beginning when she meets, I don't want to keep calling her Trinity, but by habit, I keep calling her Trinity.
Carrie Ann Moss.
Just call her Hogarth.
Jerry Hogarth.
Yeah, because Hogarth's easy because they didn't change that part of the name. But yeah, well, anyway, when she meets Carrie Ann, she's talking to her about her next job, which is serving someone papers. Some guy that she has to go track down and serve papers that he's very difficult to find.
She depends on her Hogarth to give her work so she can...
So she can buy another bottle of whiskey.
So she can get more booze.
And that leads to her first display of power that we see, which is where she holds up the guy's car where he can't drive away, and that's how she serves the papers. It was just to show us what she does. And also during this investigation, she went to like an ex-roommate as a result of disappearing, but Hope's ex-roommate, to see if she could get some information from her over there.
Yeah, and by the way, having dealt with some sort of the way up their own ass experimental film people in film school and whatnot, which is like, no, I'm doing like a whole thing with the GoPro and whatnot. It's like, no, I it's a continuous take. I can't have no cuts. And then she just yanks it off. It's like, oh, I found one. And I was like, God damn it, I love you right now.
Perfect. Now, as she's stalking Luke Cage, she's kind of she's caught by him, and you know he makes a move on her too, and like invites into the bar.
Yeah, because she's looking through the window of the bar outside on the sidewalk, and he
happens to be taking out trash.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so they talk, they flirt a little bit, they drink. And next thing you know, it's on like popcorn. You know, the sexual tension just takes over, and they're in the bed getting it on.
Yeah, but you know what was cool about that scene? That was my favorite scene of the whole first episode, because you really get to confirm the chemistry between the two of them as playing Luke Cage and Jessica Jones. Like before they get to the banging part, like when they're just in the bar talking,
that chemistry
is
going to be important later on, not just in the show. Or in Luke's show, but to both of those characters together, if you're familiar with how they are from the books.
Well, no, that's 2001. We can talk about that. This is spoilery. Well, like, obviously,
I mean, even from now, because again, they're still married.
Yeah, exactly. They are married, and it's interesting to see them. It's been so long since we've seen them not together, so it's cool to see the origin rewritten.
That's true. That is true. Fair enough. Then I would say. And speaking of these first three episodes, you know, you speaking of character dynamics. Kilgrave's barely in these first three episodes, and yet immediately off the bat, his presence is immediately felt. It is much akin to how, like, again, how they deliberately did this with Kingpin back
for
in
sure.
Middle. It's like, right, yeah, it's like right. It's like there. You know, you get these first three episodes, but you know, you get a full on appearance barely after teasing and being in the shadows. And it's effective.
They do a good job of slow building up the villain.
Yeah, the scene where she's just like laying there, and you see him like come over and lick the side of her face, and like she jumps.
Yeah, that was creepy as fuck.
It's cool that they managed to, even if you're not a comic reader, I feel like they gave just a casual viewer enough information on him as Kilgrave that you still get an impression of how dangerous he is.
Oh no, they perfectly captured how perfect. I will note one scene in particular that noted how scary he is, and what he does is when he just goes to that random family's bar and is like, "You'd like to invite me in?" Absolutely.
Oh, and with the kids, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like children are best seen, not heard. Or better yet, not seen and not heard.
Of course they
get
do.
In a closet.
That's creepy how well you got that voice.
Kilgrave?
you do not remember me. Go the fuck away.
I can't get any pheromones from here, man.
You see, that scene really, really did help the show. It's like, this guy's scary. It is a real, again, even in the shadows, it's like, you know, when you see just gone to the subway and it goes for the dark lights and you see the silhouette of him, it's like, Jessica. And she smashes the window in response. It's effective.
And very frightening. But before we go too far off track, I want to get back to Surfer's Path on here, which is back at the sex scene, where they have a sex scene, and where she goes into the bathroom and finds a picture of Luke Cage's ex-wife, or his dead wife, rather.
That wasn't in the first
episode. Was actually episode three.
No, but she sees the picture. She sees the picture when she first goes in there. It happens twice in the first episode.
She sees it. She does see it, and they don't.
They're at her place. So
they're at his place because the picture.
She rips his shirt off.
I'm literally looking at the first episode right now, and I'm looking at her looking in the cabinet at the wife's picture.
Okay.
Definitely. Like, I'm at it right now.
Good. If you guys have our own fact checker. That's good.
27 minutes and 58 seconds in. I promise.
And by the way, I should note that character is Marvel canon. That is Reva Connors, who was at one time Luke Cage's wife, until she was, you know, and she sadly met her end by the Magi.
And when she opens the cabinet, she sees the picture of the ex-wife in there, and it just causes her to tear a little bit. And at the time, we don't realize why it affects her that way. We're just thinking on a general level that maybe, you know, she's sleeping with, you know, a guy, and then she sees another picture in his bathroom. It's awkward. But when we find out and confirm the identity of this character, then we understand why she had that negative reaction.
Right, because he does reassure her after she sees it the first time, and he goes, oh, she's dead.
And she leaves the apartment and throws up. And it's funny how all of these things seem like it's because she had a one night stand and drank too much and everything. And then it just had a negative effect. But it's really because when she saw the picture, it was a reminder to her of the reason she's really stalking him.
And a good reason why she is who she is right now.
Now,
yeah. Fun fact, I have it on in the background still. If you have subtitles on, when it gets to the part where she throws up, it just says in the bottom, "Leching."
Surfer, you were saying?
So, I was going to say, you start to see the dread take over her, this person, where she's not sure whether she should confront what's going on or run off and take flight. And you know, she's not sure just if Kilgrave is still alive, and she feels he may be out there, and so she's trying to decide whether she should take off and run from this guy or not.
Yeah.
And the only person she's friends with, okay, who's Trish Walker, the only person that's naturally believes everything she says, even though she has maybe a small doubt that this guy's still out there.
Yeah, just to go a little bit back, the way she confirms that this is the Purple Man, I keep calling him that, I don't know why, but this way she confirms
name.
Yeah, is she finds out about credit card purchase history, and that she realizes that she's purchasing the same kind of lingerie from the same place that Jessica Jones had to do it for the Purple Man, and that was like one of her hints. Then she goes to like the restaurant that he took her to, because she sees that the purchase history leads her there. So slowly she starts to piece together, because she's seeing through the credit card history and these familiar traces.
Then he realized the man that recommended Jessica to Hope's parents is the Purple Man himself. Because again, Hope is just a pawn in Kilgrave's sick revenge plan of wanting to get Jessica back.
And so she does find Hope, reunites her with her parents, but Hope is still brainwashed by this character who goes off and kills her parents in front of Jessica, which of course gets her in trouble.
Wow, that was really fast. Hold on, Surfer, you got to slow that down a little. Holy shit. Okay. She found Hope and killed the parents in the same sentence.
Yeah, killed the parents in the first episode.
But I like that. I like that. No, it's like, if we're going to get to the nitty gritty, we're going to get to the nitty gritty, and we're just going to go deep. But
just to step into that a little bit slower. Just a little bit slower, not much slower. Anyway, first thing she does is she tells the parents to leave town, because when she realizes that this is Kilgrave. And then she tries to go to Trish for money, and then she finds Hope tied to the bed. And when she asks Hope to leave, she says she's not able to leave. She asks her how long she's been sitting there. Then she tries to struggle with Hope, and Hope refuses to leave. She says that she wet the bed, so she gets her like a jacket, and then she's trying to struggle, and like Hope's breaking like lamps and shit. And as she's carrying out the way out of the room, it's kind of funny because it's sad and I feel bad, but I was kind of glad when she took that bump on the way out the door. Like, she didn't clear the door, so Hope's head hits and she shuts the fuck up because she gets knocked unconscious. So then she's just carrying an unconscious person instead of a lunatic. Because she's
like, that whole scene made me think of that movie Secretary.
You too, huh? You're thinking for her in the wedding dress, aren't you?
When she's sitting at the end at the table and her fiance comes and she's like, "I'm not leaving," and she starts peeing herself.
Oh, goddamn.
But yeah, when she took that head bump, I kind of chuckled a little, even though she's a victim. It was like she was really ripping the lamps and banging the door. I'm surprised that cops didn't come. And then you just hear thunk and it's quiet. And then now Jessica Jones can take her ass out without there being a problem anymore. And then
you're also surprised cops didn't come, because again, like, you know, who the fuck pulled the fire alarm?
All right, so yeah, Surfer, take it from here. I know you were dying to get to the parents getting murdered for some reason. So he wants to get to the murder.
She thinks, okay, she's reunited the person with her parents. She's telling them just get the hell out of town, not realizing that Hope is still brainwashed. She purposely kills the parents in front of Jessica so that affect her.
When he controls you for,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, when he controls you for that amount of time, it leaves, because he has to control you from within his range. He has to be close to you. Well, when he controls you for that amount of time, it lingers with you, and it has residual effects like that. So it's not that he was still controlling her, but the residual effects of due to the duration that she was under that made her react like that. It was almost like a knee-jerk reaction.
Okay, that's cool. I honestly didn't know that.
Well, yeah, he just can't keep controlling you forever, like wherever you are.
Eventually, I want you to make sure you kill your parents in front of Jessica, because that was the point of her doing it, not just to get rid of the parents, but to make sure Jessica saw it would affect her. And Jessica's at this point, this is at the end of the first episode, where she's ready to take flight, but she's thinking, maybe I shouldn't now. I should not run. I should do something about this, because this man is dangerous. He's going to hurt more people. He's going to hurt more people on my behalf.
Mm-hmm. And the eerie thing about with this is the way they show the viewers, just the impression you get of how frightening this guy is when the elevator, as it's closing, and the last shot that you get is of Hope smiling and pulling out the gun like a fucking psycho. And you're thinking, no way. And then she starts to go down the steps, and you already know there's no way in
hell.
You're
hearing it as she's running down the steps, the gunshots.
Yeah, and then when the elevator opens,
But I want to praise the editing team. Like, the editing on that is absolutely fantastic. And here's the thing. Speaking of that, I'm surprised because I thought at first, like, why didn't they explore some certain options? That's later brought up in another episode, but I'll save it for that. It's like, if she what if she contemplated this option, whatnot, just to try and stop him, make sure this wouldn't have to happen. I think you know what I'm getting at. Starts with an S, but
hindsight is 2020, though.
But again, it's like, there could have been like some rich story they could have explored with that. But I'm happy with where they took this. And yeah, that ending of the first episode is like, god damn, because of what happens. Because again, Rick did bring up, yes, Purple Man, Kilgrave does need to be within a good range of you, but again, his voice can carry. And I'm not saying he was yelling that much.
He had a megaphone.
It was like, kill your fucking parents!
Kill your parents!
And whatnot, over like 1,000 loudspeakers, a la Bart Simpson. But
I was going to use a wrestling reference and say Vince McMahon in the commentary team's there.
God damn that! Okay. That too. That, but both would have worked either way. But
mind controlling people into suicide way before Ivan Ooze.
God damn! Okay, I was waiting on that. I was waiting on the goddamn Ivan Ooze reference. Like, son of a bitch, another influential Purple Man. How many episodes did we do before that's brought up?
Think about it. We never made that connection. We're the first people to solve the puzzle here, but Ivan Ooze was the Purple Man.
Even though Purple Man makes Ivan Ooze look like a bitch.
He was literally the Purple Man. He made their parents try to walk off a cliff. All of them.
Yeah, although Purple Man looks at him and was like, oh, that's cute.
Now, this episode was directed by S.J. Clarkson.
Who directed the first two episodes, Ladies Night and Crush Syndrome.
That brings us to the second episode.
Yeah, I believe that episode's called Kidney Guy. No, I'm kidding. It's not called that.
God damn it.
So with Crush Syndrome now, so we were dealing with the fallout of Hope murdering her parents. And so, of course, she's arrested. And Jessica's kind of being investigated for being in the vicinity. They're trying to find out what happened. And, of course, they just assume that, it's a cut and dry case of a woman just murdering her parents. But yeah. Jessica has to convince them that, no, there's a guy out there who with powers to manipulate and control people that forced her to do it. And that's kind of hard to believe for the average person. So, of course, she has to try to get proof to help this person who's sitting in jail and probably going to go to jail for the rest of her life, if not more, like, executed.
Now, I believe in the interrogation room, it may have been later, but that might have been the scene where she does an Avengers reference and she mentions, you won't believe this, but you'll believe, we've had, a battle in New York or else.
Sort of thing. And by the way, I got excited. In that, not just because, hey, it's a good scene, but it had my favorite TV cop in it. That was Clark Peters playing Detective Clemens. Clark Peters, who played my favorite TV detective, Lester Freeman from The Wire.
As she tries to get Hogarth to help Hope, and she sees that as a losing case.
Yeah, well, first she leaves when she gets let out of the interrogation, the first place she tries to go is to Luke Cage's bar. And when she gets there and looks through the window, he's being interrogated by the cops. And that pisses him off to no end, where he tells her, I don't want people in my business. And, you know, it causes like a little rift between the two of them, because he's, you know, he's probably secretive about everything. Let's keep in mind, he has the origin of getting experimented on and everything. He's trying to keep a low profile.
He's ex-con, you know, even though he went to jail for something he really didn't do, but he is known to be a ex-convict, and, you know, he doesn't have if you know Luke Cage's history, he does not have the best relationship with the police.
No.
And he knows, you know, the system can really screw you over. And he's just trying to keep a low profile. But it's kind of hard with Jessica Jones being around and, you know, the backlash she's causing through just being Jessica Jones.
What I like about the second episode is that it is a great continuation. It's a nice little pickup from where the pilot ends and where it just keeps going. It's like we're getting to know more about Jessica. We get more Luke, which is good.
We get a little Hope and Jessica in the interrogation room, where she just goes over her experience with the Purple Man.
Yeah, exactly. That's wonderful. I honestly enjoy it. And again, we get a little bit more of a glimpse of Kilgrave lingering around in the shadows.
And Jessica is realizing more and more, this is not about Hope, it's all about her. Everything is about Kilgrave coming back on her.
It's a sick revenge plot.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is, and she realizes she's going to have to really overcome this.
Yeah, she goes to Carrie Ann to try to get her to help, and Carrie Ann does it under the condition of owing her a favor.
Which, by the way, is a common trope among these sort of detective noir stories. It's like, hey, you owe me one, you know, whatnot. And, you know, that almost always comes back to bite some people in the ass. And especially when you're dealing with a lawyer. Does it literally come back
to bite her in the ass this time?
Hey, whatever she and Luke do in bed is their business. But, but you know, especially when you're dealing with someone like a lawyer, especially a lawyer such as Jerry Hogarth, which episode two allows us a little bit more of Carrie Ann Moss as Hogarth, and starts to help plant the seeds along with the first episode of her very own complex and layered side story.
Yeah, with the love affair going on, and you see the office, the tension in that office.
Yeah, within the story, and that's incredible. And by the way, this is the best I've seen Carrie Ann Moss in a while, because her coldness, the coldness coming off her character, not only would make you say, here, hold this, and you could chill, and you could like have an instant cold glass of whiskey without having any ice, but it's harkened back memories of like her performances and things such as Memento. It's really incredible how she was.
I totally forgot she was in that.
How can you forget? She's like a main part of Memento.
Dude, I haven't watched Memento in like almost, 8 years?
Did you watch Memento, or did you think you watched Memento?
She plays that Power Woman very well. I mean, look at it in contrast to that cartoony Power Woman that we have in Supergirl.
Yeah, no, exactly. I absolutely love what they were doing with her and how they were, again, setting this up very well.
Now, of course, you feel Jessica like her life is unraveling slowly. You know, she's afraid that anybody that's around her is going to get hurt in the crossfire, and she wants to push people away. She wants to push away Trish, and Trish is trying to help her as a friend, but she just feels that if she gets too close to people, it's going to that Kilgrave is going to use these people to hurt her in some way by hurting them.
By hurting them, ultimately killing them.
Yeah, and also I wanted to mention in the bar scene, we forgot to go over that, that's also where Jessica Jones reveals to Luke Cage that she was in fact spying on him, but she gives him a false story. She tells him that it was because she was hired to do so.
By, with the, hired by the husband of the woman that Luke at that time is sleeping with.
Which resulted
and
in
who,
that woman.
And who is duping her and saying like, oh no, I'm not married.
Yeah, which resulted in that woman asking her husband when she didn't need to and getting
like,
busted.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, because the woman first goes to Luke Cage and back to the bar basically to get some more Luke. And then inadvertently, he winds up telling
her,
hey, listen.
Can you blame her?
Okay, you on. Know, is he the man crush, the official man crush of this show?
I'm not touching that.
I didn't think you would.
Hey, I'm comfortable enough with myself to say maybe. Shut up. Don't judge. Hey, my girlfriend doesn't judge me.
Girls be hating. Anyway, so she shows up at the bar and, you know, he says, you know, you could put your wedding ring back on. And she says that the marriage hasn't been that good in a long time. She basically said, we don't even do oral sex anymore, which I love how that was the standard. Like, I don't even put
that
a dick in my mouth. You know, like, and that doesn't tell you something about
that. But you're still doing hand stuff? Is that what
that's what I was. You see, I like Jordan. He's at the same train of thought. He literally took the words out of my mouth.
Well, hand stuff I could tolerate, but if you're putting his dick in your mouth, then.
Yeah, like that was going to make Luke Cage go, oh, if you're not blowing him, all right, then sure.
I mean, hey, if you're just jerking him off, that's cool.
I think it's more, you know, the stereotype about black men and what they won't do orally. So I think that's what they was implying, but I could be wrong.
Well, we don't even, yeah, but hey, whatever.
Well, would you want to give her oral sex if you knew Luke Cage was all up in that? No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
That's not what I'm saying.
I'm just kidding, man. It's a joke. I'm completely, no, obviously. That's...
Welcome to the Talk Brunch team.
So, I mean, like.
We get it.
And then she's so paranoid at this point that everybody that comes to her, she feels that maybe, you know, this Kilgrave character is controlling them or sending her to do harm to her or harm them in front of her. So like her door's broken in the first episode. So her friend Trish sends somebody over to fix the door, which that person ends up getting hurt because she doesn't realize that someone was sent over to fix her door and she just sees an intruder and she roughs him up and really hurts him. He has to go to the hospital. So she's really in paranoid mode. And at the same time, it's just life is just crappy.
Yeah, and there's always an emphasis on her door, too, because Hope's father was trying to fix her door while they're trying to find the daughter. Mm. And there was even another scene.
Yeah, the door becomes its own recurring sort of thing and even a theme of how constantly broken that Jessica Jones is.
It's funny because as soon as they fixed it, I was like, how many episodes until this thing gets broken again?
Well, ain't gonna take long.
Yeah. Before we even got to the scene of the door, there was another scene that happened where we get to meet her two kooky neighbors. I don't know if you guys remember the little
Reuben and twincest. Robin.
Twincesters.
Played by Kieran Mulcair was Reuben and Colby Menifee was Robin.
Yeah, and they're always making noise. I think they're upstairs from her, is it? They're like on the floor.
They're directly above her.
The noise is either from them arguing, shit, like stomping around, that's mainly it. They're just fucking arguing a lot, which you do as siblings. So,
yeah, shit happens, you know, but when we get up there, we find out that there's a little bit more than arguing going on. First of all, we get the impression that this is a couple before we find out that they're siblings. The second thing we find out is when Jessica Jones says, I don't know what kind of kinky shit you guys are into, but I don't give a bag of dicks or something like that. Just keep your noise down. And you're thinking, man, she's being really harsh to this nice couple. And then the camera pans out.
We're
in his underwear. He was in his tidy whiteies or something. Would you be in your tidy whiteies?
Well, here's the thing. Reuben is a special child. He's a bit mentally disabled.
It's still weird. I mean, come on. Whether it's
a grown adult man in his tidy whities,
just out there in his underwear.
Hey, some grown men still wear tidy whities. Not me, because like, no, fuck that. But hey, whatever, man. Whatever works for their junk. But
Yeah, but you don't want to see it work for us anyway.
Ruben's a bit of a slow guy.
He's slow to put on his pants.
Hey, first off, when you come home, what's the first thing you do? You take off your pants, because fuck that. I mean, come on.
Yeah, but then
you know what would have been worse? If his pants was off later on when we see him, when he catches Jessica and Luke together.
Okay, you actually have a fair point.
But then we find out that they're brother and sister. So let me ask you something, McWrestling, right? It's your sister's birthday. Happy birthday to her.
Fuck her.
How would she react if you just showed up in your underwear to wish her happy birthday later on tonight? Like, and just acted normal about everything about you was the same except you're in your underwear. And it's just, you add your same mannerisms and everything.
Hey, what's up?
You know that meme that I post with the little girl looking at you like, what the fuck? That's the look that I would get.
Yeah, you know what? It was like I said, it was just to show you another dimension of how kinky and weird and strange people are in this world. Like, everyone in this series has something weird or unusual about them.
So it's kind of like,
yeah, this is definitely the bowels of the Marvel Universe that we're in right now. And it was done very well, man. It was done really well.
Yeah, no, the second episode really did a good job at helping to further explore and widen the view of this certain corner of the world that we're being exposed to at this time. It really did a great job at that. And I feel like that's what helped make the second episode so strong and really makes you say, man, I was already with this first episode, but I am now in deeper with it. I'm like, I'm ready to watch a lot more.
Yeah, and I like the way Jessica Jones is assuming all these different identities. Like in the first episode, when she's sitting on her toilet, she's talking to someone over the phone, and she's imitating like being like a secretary or something to get information. And then in the second episode, just getting back to where we are right now in the story, she goes to a hospital and she disguises herself as like, I guess, one of the orderlies or something, or
one of the new orderlies that didn't know how to get around.
She said she's from the hospital from Grey's Anatomy. How funny is that to say the Grey's Anatomy hospital as the place she's from? What was it, Grace Academy or whatever it is? And they're like, oh, wow, like the TV show? I couldn't believe she got away with that.
You know, that's something you normally wouldn't see somebody doing something as going to the bathroom. And
I was just about to say that's the scene that actually sold it for me. And I was like, this is my type of show.
Like, it's the one, yeah. You know, you can see scenes like where they go to the sink and wash their face, but not just sit on the toilet and go.
Right. Like,
well, that's
very
an actual panel. Well, I just remember it's an actual panel from a comic of Jessica Jones where it shows like a narration when she's like sitting on the toilet.
It's a very realistic atmosphere.
You don't see on TV.
No, I agree. No. I'm agreeing with you in that too. And that's what I honestly love about that scene. It's like, it's given this show a deeper feel.
Yeah, it really does. It reminds me of that show. What's that show where the father's always drunk?
Married with Children?
You're going to be way more specific.
Unhappily Ever After.
Shit.
So like many Shameless TV shows.
Shameless. There you go.
Oh, yeah.
I can't believe I said where the father's always drunk and your first fucking reach was Married with Children.
Hold on. First off, can you blame him? Secondly.
No, I don't like his beers, but Jesus, how could you put that on Al? Of all people, Al Bundy drunk all the time?
I was like, wait, no, you must be talking about something more modern, and it's something I watched. So I was just like, Shameless.
After meeting some of the neighbors, and of course, she doesn't get along with them. They don't like her in particular, you know.
She doesn't really get along with anybody.
She don't like people. You can tell she's, you know, one of the things, before I continue, one of the things about, I noticed that like each time they show a scene where she wakes up from bed, it's like it's harder and harder for her to climb out of bed. She's just dreading waking up, and it's like she's waking up from like from a hangover half the time, and just, you know, she's not taking on life at this point. So the woman that Luke Cage is seeing, that's supposed to be married, but of course Luke Cage didn't know, confronts Jessica about the fact that, you know, Jessica has been spying on them, and that Luke, I guess, confronted her about her husband. Her husband found out. So now the husband got some of his friends worked up to go and beat up Luke Cage, not knowing, of course, who Luke Cage is, just thinking he's just an ordinary guy in a bar. She goes to the bar to try to help him. Of course, neither one knows that the other is super enhanced in their abilities. And a bar fight breaks out, of course, and it's funny watching her. It's like she's beating up guys, but she's still struggling a bit where he's just like just throwing these people off, like, you know, they're just flies, just ignoring, being annoying, like, because, you know, he's impervious to most pains and his skin doesn't break. So
yeah,
it's just backhanded people away when they attack, where she's struggling more to throw them, but she's still throwing people across the bar.
Oh, yeah.
like they're rag dolls.
And in a scene, I like the title, Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, Giver of No Fucks. Because, again, that to me really helps sell me further. I'm like, this is Luke Cage. This is absolutely Luke Cage.
She discovers that he has unbreakable skin because he is stabbed. And, of course, the knife breaks.
Because of a mysterious prison experiment that went wrong.
Are we just going to gloss over the kidney guy, though? Like, no kidney guy in this version?
What do you mean? No, we're not glossing. But go ahead.
Yeah, there was a scene where Jessica Jones, during her investigation, she's tracking down one of the people that was driving the ambulance, and she comes across the guy that's sitting. He donated. The purple man made him give up both of his kidneys to him, which is how he managed to survive. Remember, he had multiple kidney failure.
And how she found out his weakness, which is that, you know, anesthesia.
Yeah, anesthesia and the needle, exactly. Because
anesthesia and needles, you know, which would null his powers.
Exactly, because the guy's sitting there and she says, you know, it turns out, ironically, unluckily enough for this gentleman, his mother is a religious fanatic. So she's sitting there and she's like, oh, my baby gave up both of his kidneys. He was very, you know, and the guy has no kidneys. And the doctor says that the purple man could have lived with just one kidney, but he insisted on being complete. So he wanted both kidneys. So
this resulted that God didn't do this; the devil did. And it's like,
yeah. And then we find out as a result of that basically the guy, he refused to be put to sleep when these kidneys were being transplanted into him, and that's the reason, because that's the weakness of him losing his power. And like Jordan said, that's like, how we find out his weakness.
Not only will it knock me out, it ain't going to make me do shit.
Yeah, and then it's messed up because we think that he's going to write Kilgrave. Well, I knew he wasn't going to write it, but he takes a piece of paper when the mother goes near him and he starts to write kill, and she's like, I know Kilgrave, and he writes kill me, and he's giving her this look like, come on, please.
Even when she walks away, he's like, come on.
Yeah. Oh my God, do you know what I go for every day? Can you please just put a pillow over my face?
I felt so bad, the look on his face, you know?
30 seconds. Yay. Half a minute.
She even looked back and was like, sorry, bro. Can't do it.
He's looking at her like, bruh, half a minute. Come on.
Seriously, bro? Seriously, bro, you can't hit a switch? I like the fact that she used that later on to call the machine company, because she wanted to track where that machine was bought from, because the machine keeping him alive is a very expensive machine. So she used the name brand. She takes her cell phone and she photographs the name of it. And then later on, when she calls the company to follow up on it, she says that it's not defibrillating properly or something like that.
That is what she said, right? I was like, wait, what?
That's something weird. She said something really weird, like a non-word.
About the same hospital as one Claire Temple works.
You know what it was? It's not dialysizing properly, because it was a dialysis machine, and she's like, your machine's not dialysizing.
I hope she didn't say defibrillating.
The shit ain't working right.
As if dialysizing is any better.
This shit ain't working right. Where'd you get it? You know, and all that. Proper detective work, you know, and whatnot.
Yeah, great detective work in here.
It is great in that scene. Like, going back to where she does find a guy, and it's like, it is a very nicely done tense scene where she is like, as you mentioned, it's Kilgrave, but, you know, the moment he spells out kill me, it takes on a whole different scene. And again, that scene also helps to show the influence of Kilgrave himself, just furthering, like, what a honestly a force of nature this guy is.
Yeah, and then, like you said, then after that we had the whole bar fight scene, like, as one of the big climaxes. Yeah, because you really get to see how strong he is.
And you also really get the further scenes. Like, this is also like the first scenes you can see Christian Ritter really start kicking ass. And that's fantastic. Because, again, I know it's like, oh, man, she don't look right. But, again, Christian Ritter was perfect for this, because she even went on and put out, like, muscle for this role. She went on about I think when I ran about 10 pounds of muscle and trained heavy for like 2 months, I'd be like, after reading like all the aliases, you'd be like, oh my God, I'm loving this. Hey, can you give me more? It's like, yo. It was like, hey, we appreciate your enthusiasm, but chill. Chill. Yeah,
so then after that is the scene that I briefly mentioned a little while ago where she comes across the college professor, chases his ass down, finds out about Killjoy's weaknesses. No, not Killjoy.
Hey, we'll talk about a very decisive My Chemical Romance album later. But right now we're talking about Jessica Jones. Yeah, anyway, yes, she tracks down the professor that Kilgrave man's like, you're gonna put both of these kidneys in me. Fuck this guy. Both of them now. And yeah, it's a nicely done scene. It's pretty good.
Yeah,
so after I will that, say the one thing they have not shown is the main character go semi or totally nude in any of these sex scenes she's been doing.
Yeah, Marvel still ain't gonna go with the nude.
Yeah, they're not gonna go there.
Yeah, you don't want anything even like though that I right thought, now. You're gonna take away
this
the innocence.
Is kind of the
you don't want
you'd want to do it with, but
okay. You don't want to split your audience where people who watch Avengers can't watch. You know, Jessica Jones or
although really it's like, hey, I can take my kid to see the Avengers. Maybe he'll like this Jessica Jones series. Okay, this is the first time I'm being dead serious. Don't fucking show your kid this show. This is the first time I'm being dead serious. No. No.
You so get to decide
Daredevil,
that.
Okay, slightly maybe, but no ish. Jessica Jones? No. Wait until like they're like 16 or shit or around that time.
So is there anything we missed as far as the second episode? Or
After that, we just had Carrie Ann Moss going to meet Hope and just convince her not to take the public defender.
Yeah, she decides to take the case, and help Hope in.
Be like, I'm going to represent you. You deal with it, you know, all that. It's very interesting in that regard. I honestly really like that.
Jessica has to try to find other victims of Kilgrave so they can show that this is not an isolated incident, that there is a guy out there who has the ability to control and manipulate people.
Yeah, because I believe that's also the episode where Trish is talking about this supposed Kilgrave on her radio show.
Well, yeah, that's the third episode. But
okay, fuck, I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah, so, well, don't worry, we're about to wrap out too, because at the end, basically, she has a conversation with Hellcat over the phone, and this is where we get a little sign that she's Hellcat because she's bleeding from her nose, and she's like she has some sort of a workout room in the back that she's been using. Like she looks a little bruised because she's sort of, I guess she's trying to superhero
herself.
And
there's a nosebleed that drips into her water.
Yeah, that's sexy.
But you see the signs of it before when she's in the office, and then I can't remember exactly who's coming in, but the guy turns around and he was like, you better cover up. And you see the little bruises on her.
Yeah, and then we get one last Purple Man scene where he steps into that family's house, steps in the kid's car, his toy car, throws them in the closet, and, you know, that whole we brought it up earlier.
Yeah, pretty much being Rick James is like, yo, fuck your couch.
He takes over a home so he can live comfortably while
warned of a very particular palate.
Yeah, and then finally Luke Cage confronts Jessica Jones with his little saw, like, look, I can cut my stomach. I know we're both...
With a buzzsaw. With a goddamn buzzsaw, he takes right to his, stomach and be like... And he gives such the most chill look as he's laying a buzzsaw into himself, being like, hey...
What kind of fights was he in that he would know a buzzsaw wouldn't cut his stomach? I guess after a while, right?
Hey, well, hey, maybe we'll find out in the Luke Cage.
I mean, he did get stabbed in the neck during the bar fight, too.
Well, he's basically bulletproof, so I don't see where a saw could, you know, pierce his skin. If he can't.
It could be what fight or just his own, like, personal experimentation of this. Like, well, the glass didn't do anything. Not after that fight, but prior to that, well... Glass bottles can't hurt me. Can a knife cut me? Can this cut me? Can that cut me?
Yeah. Can the deep words of my judgmental mother cut me?
I think they probably won't establish until we get to his series that he's probably been at this for a while. Like,
right, right.
Thing, yeah. Going through. So he knows that he's impervious to any, like if you shot him, you'd have to have armor piercing bullets to pierce his skin. Anything below yeah. that is just going to bounce off. You can't hurt him. He can still feel pain. You know, yeah, if you can shoot him, he'll feel it. It just won't penetrate.
Yeah, because, like, honestly, an average 9mm pistol is just going to be, like, child play against Luke Cage. It's going to be like, is that the best you got? Really?
And so, you know, so he confronts her. And, you know, them now knowing that that the other person has abilities, you know, it makes their attraction even more intense.
Yeah. And, which leads us over to episode 3.
Which, speaking of intense attraction, hey, hardcore fucking!
So the episode's called, it's called Whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay, what does the Lone Ranger guy do in this episode?
Because he was...
was he watching them? Was he watching Luke and Jessica from a window?
No, it just means that they're off.
These guys went in. Like, they were banging like all over the place. They were banging all over the place. So anyway, yeah, there was a lot of fucking going on in this episode. So much, in fact. They went out to eat, to energize. And we're the viewers are privy to this because they go out to eat. They stuff their faces. And then it's once again back to the sex.
And, you know, since now they didn't know that neither one can be hurt if they go all out, you know, they decide to go all out and make it rough, rugged, and raw.
I think they have sex 3 times in this episode.
You almost ask yourself, man, how do they have the energy? And you're like, oh wait, right.
Oh, you know when you meet somebody that you really are sexually compatible with, it is going to happen a lot early on. So them doing it more than a couple of times in a short period of time, that makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. I mean. You know, they got hot bodies and they're attracted to each other and it's all.
Why is the music still playing?
God damn it. Are you still playing a fucking William Teller overture?
We're still talking about sex, man.
they definitely did go at it a couple of times to the point when I gotta admit, I was getting jealous. I was like, come on, man.
It's just jungle
food. Yeah, no, it's...
Which he does ask her that at some point. He was like, is it a racial thing?
Yeah.
I'm still hearing the fucking theme in my head. Thanks.
Let's be honest now. This is a taboo for television to have a black male and a white female.
Is it really at this point?
Hell no.
In some cases, yes. I mean, I'm not.
No,
hold on. If you're living in. Hold on. If you're living in Kentucky.
I'm not saying that.
Listen.
It's a taboo, especially in Mississippi.
To some people, this is something they don't want to see.
What are we in the South? Come on, man. Listen.
Hey, I live in the South. And let me tell you, Mississippi will be outraged by this episode.
Yeah, see what I mean? Like, out here, that's not. Put it this way. If we were to go back 10 years, right? About 10 years, Gunn was already banging Fred on Angel. You know,
dude, remember in Heroes, you had
Heroes too. You know, we had Micah's that couple. Parents. Micah's parents.
I got to step out of character for a second, okay?
But girls want dick, no matter what.
No, I got to step out of character for a second, okay? Let's look at the two characters, okay? You know, and I had a friend said to me, "Why didn't you tell me Christian Ritter was so white?" And she is very pale, okay.
I was about to say, what does that mean?
I don't make this stuff up. Where is this going? I don't make up the rules. Then you got Luke Cage. You know, this is the whole Mandingo scenario. You know, big strapping black man. And it upsets some people. Now, I'm not saying I'm upset. I'm thinking, where's been the sex in
it's funny because I watched a scene and that is not what went through my mind at all.
Well, I didn't say that I had a problem with. I'm telling you.
No, I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying.
People who are looking at this and they are uncomfortable with it.
People who are uncomfortable with it, welcome to 2015. Get with the program.
Yeah, who's uncomfortable with it? Hulk Hogan?
Brother.
Let me tell you something. I was actually binge watching Jessica Jones.
They need to at least be a 7 foot tall.
Up until she was fucking that. Hulk, stop!
It's just weird to think about that people would bring up the race thing this far down. Like, how unusual would that be, right?
Yeah, what the fuck ever. Look, my thing is, it really is like, whatever. So you're white, he's black, the fuck ever. Hey, more power to you. Hey, you know what your heart and genitals want.
Now, she's still hard drinking. She's still, like, she's still walking around paranoid, you know. She feels that Kilgrave could be right around the corner or somebody under his control. She's taking it upon herself that she has to stop him.
Also, we do get the cabinet now, the time you were talking about, Surfer, where you see the picture in the cabinet once again haunting her when she looks into the medicine cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's perfectly done. And
you discover that the woman that of this picture ties into her past with Kilgrave and how she originally broke free of his control, you know, during the... How long was she under this man's control? Like, was it months? Was it years?
Months. Yeah. It was much like in Alias comic. It was very much months. Like, not a full year, but enough of a long extended period of time that it significantly fucked her with all the things they were doing and whatnot. Especially in the comic, with everything that happened. In the comic, it was 8 months. It was 8 months that she was under the control of Kilgrave. And I believe that's about the same amount of time they did in the TV show.
That's a long time of being mind raped and physically raped.
That's over half a year. That's over half of a year.
Yeah. And we also kind of glossed over, we didn't mention there. She has, like, I guess, basically safety words that her psychiatrist taught her in order to resist Kilgrave's.
Calling back the streets.
Yeah, I forget the names of the streets. They come into play, ironically, about where I am in the series.
Birch. I know is one of them.
It doesn't matter. They're streets. You didn't live there. As long as
I know
she knows
where I live, anyway. Yeah. But yeah, no.
Your address. That's what matters.
And I want to bring up a character that really gets to come into her own in this episode, and that really is more Trish, played by Rachel Taylor, who's great. I think Trish really gets to honestly come into her own, because the way they further flesh out and go into her and Jessica's friendship is really nicely done. It's like, you know, you get little details like, you know, how Jessica's like, you know, lunch is something you eat, not do. And it's like that's a believable interaction. I would believe two people that known each other this long would honestly have, and it's very good.
Yeah, and then Trish reveals her physical strength and stuff as far as what she's doing.
While taking on Will Simpson, that one possessed cop. And
well,
whatnot.
No, by when she
prior
first,
to that, she's able to take her down with the juice.
Yeah, prior exactly. to that, she takes her into the gym room.
It shows Trish is tough, but she's not as invincible as Jessica. Almost is. The fight that Trish and Jessica has highlights different characteristics about themselves.
When
Trish,
she flips
again,
her over.
Tough, yep. But vulnerable. While Jessica shows her compassion, because again, even when given like a, like, hey, is she going to take down the nemesis or an innocent life? Jessica's always going to make the humane choice, and that's she's going to save Trish rather than take this opportunity to go and get out of get after Kilgrave and whatnot.
Yeah, when Trish shows Jessica that back room where she's been working on stuff and she flips her over and stuff, that to me was an example of the inconsistency, though, as far as her power goes, where it's like a regular human being should not be able to flip you like that, even if it's Hellcat, because she doesn't have any strength established powers or anything, or any force fuels or any of that shit. So that was kind of weird.
I kind of disagree, because it's not like she's you can't pick her up. She is the weight of a normal person. And so if you take her by surprise, you could flip her over, which that's what happened in that scene. She took Jessica by surprise and flipped her over.
I mean, it's definitely possible, I guess, but that to me makes her a little bit weaker than I would have expected her to be if you can get flipped over like that. And it happens a few more times on just this third episode where it was just kind of like, all right, well, I guess she's strong when they need her to be strong, but at other times she could be tackled to the ground.
I think it's more of a, if her mind is set to doing it, then she could probably stand her ground, but.
But that makes it more like she doesn't have superpowers. She's just a good striker. You know, she's a Holly Holm.
No, I mean, you know, lifting up the back of, end of a car, I've never been able to do that. So.
Exactly, and that's where the inconsistency to me and her strength comes. It's like, here's a person who lifted the back of a car, but
that doesn't mean she can't be thrown.
Yeah, you see, it's weird. It's just, I just find it a little bit weird. But,
okay, so she's strong enough that if she planted herself, you probably couldn't throw her. But like I said, you catch her off guard, you can flip her over probably once, and then she can put a guard up and you won't be able to do it again. So, yeah, I do buy it. Okay, I guess we don't agree on that, but I can buy into it.
Fair enough.
So she tries to get some anesthesia she tries to get?
She's trying to get a hold of the anesthesia to go after Kilgrave.
Right. So she goes to the doctor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in this episode, that's where she goes after the doctor.
And she goes to the lawyer's wife to try to get the drugs. She goes to Carrie Ann Moss's wife to try to get the drugs for her and tries to use the fact that they're getting a divorce to get her to help her out, you know? Because she's like, look, you know, your wife is a lawyer and you're not going to get much because she's going to know how to work the system. And I could be a friend for you. I can help you out, so you can come out on top when it's all said and done. And that doesn't work. But
again, I'm just going back to the fight. Again, it really is a great job of highlighting great characteristics of both Trish and Jessica. You know, the whole sequence where the possessed, you know, where the Kilgrave possessed cops, you know, trying to break in. I feel like that's just absolutely fantastic. It works in that regard.
Right. So we get a scene where Malcolm gets hit by a bike and the guy's all pissed off and he's like, you knocked into my bike, you asshole.
Yeah, and at the time you don't realize what's going on with Malcolm. You just know that he's a neighbor who's high and, you know, he lives near, but he's showing up in scenes where at first you don't realize why he's showing up, but it does get revealed later as to why he's showing up in a lot more scenes than
in the third episode. In the third episode, after the entire Malcolm scene is all said and done and all of the smoke is cleared, we're treated back to some more. Because, yes, in the middle of the episode...
And they're just giving it to each other harder and harder. I mean, like, you know, they're breaking beds, breaking walls. It reminds me of the sex scene in Dolomite.
One of my favorite...
God damn it.
I'll stop it for you. One of my favorite scenes of this episode is... later on, after they break the bed, he texts her and he says, I got the new bed. And that made me crack up because the fact that he said, I got the new bed means that there was like a prior discussion to them about the requirements of a new bed. And it's like, I got that new bed now. You know, this thing was really joy for them.
Like Luke is slowly getting whipped.
He really is. he got a new bed.
Like, you know, after each sex scene, he's contemplating. This is some good stuff.
Like, yeah, you see it. Like, he lays there and it was like, this is potentially like a long-term thing. Like, instead of it just being a booty call every now and then, he can see himself with her and them having a future together. Which is kind of weird for him to be thinking that after just meeting her. Like, I get they have the whole common thing if they have powers, but it's like, it seems like he falls in love pretty fast.
Well, this bed isn't going to break itself.
I guess not.
You know,
Luke Cage,
even though she's been obsessed with him for a long while, I don't know if she's like feeling the same on the level he's feeling for her.
Because again, for her, Luke is just a new way to possibly feel something, a new sensation that she could get, since she is just broken inside. And again, that's why, you know, we had that discussion about sexing, you know, and started the show, the whole anal sexing, you know, whatnot with the comic. Because again, it's just her, like, I need to feel. God damn it, that music's throwing me off. She needs to feel something, a new sensation, something that that could remind her, yes, I'm me, I'm human, but I'm still really not the same, and such.
Now, of course, she does such to, you know, reveal to him, you know, her situation with Kilgrave and what he can do and how she's, you know, worried.
Yeah, we get that show, the Trish show. Is that what it's called, where she's on the radio?
Yeah, Trish Talks.
Trish Talks or whatever?
They do come up with the idea beforehand. Like, the opinion of the public is that Hope is guilty, and why haven't they just thrown her under the
book at her
jail at this point? So they need to sway public opinion in her favor, thinking, so, you know, it'll work out for her. So, of course, Trish comes up with the idea of, you know, interviewing her on the radio. And I think
interviewing Hope's daughter.
For two, right? Right.
Making Kilgrave public. Because, like, you know, the boogeyman, feasts off your fears in private, but what's the greatest weakness of the boogeyman? Well, you bring him out to the light and he's exposed. So that's what they're trying to do with Kilgrave in an excellent scene where Trish sort of goes overboard and just is like, yo, shut the fuck up!
Well, okay, so they're interviewing her on the radio, and the lawyer wants to try to show that she's insane, because that's the only thing that she can come up with.
Insanity played.
Right, but Trish, knowing that there's this person out there, kind of goes off and calls him a coward and a bitch and tries to...
She goes on about how buildings were destroyed and, you know, that there are other people out there that have been controlled by him, and that this whole thing is like...
Well, it's like a basic psychology 101 sort of thing. You try to upstart a person by kind of just breaking down their facade, the image that they have of themselves, and bringing up a deep insecurity they may that might linger on them, and that's what she was trying to do. That's a deliberate move on Trish's part.
Right, but at the same time, Carrie Ann Moss was trying to steer it in the other direction. She was saying, Trish, it almost sounds like you're saying you believe Kilgrave is alive. So then she tries to trump her by saying, I believe that it's naive to assume that he isn't. And I think that's what pisses him off and puts her in the hot seat.
Yeah, that too. That also has a factor into that as well. Which is why, you know, it plays into the factor of like, you know what, fuck this bitch. Hey, you two cops.
And that's why Jessica Jones pulls the mic apart. Like, she tears the mic right off of the station, and she lets her know that, you know, listen, this guy, don't fuck with him. He's listening to us. You can't just do whatever you want. She tells him you're going to piss him off. And momentarily later, it leads to him calling in. You know, and like Trish's whole argument is it's because he's destroying lives. You know, they don't want to just sit here.
Yeah, then leads to him possessing those police officers to be like, yeah, you know what, go kill her. Just, like, I need her out of the fucking picture.
Well, before we even get to that, he threatens them over the air, and he just basically lets them know his stance on things.
A great scene.
He's such an egotist that
use of keeping Kilgrave in the shadows, but letting you know he's still around.
He's such an egotist that, you know, her being insulting to him makes him expose himself to, like, you really think if this person exists, that he's not going to take this out on you? Which is, you know, he does in such a threatening way that everybody listening knows that now Trish is in the crosshairs of Kilgrave, and that he's gonna come after her.
Yeah, and in the meantime, Hope is hysterical. Like, you know, she hears his voice and it freaks her out. And, you know, people sort of get like a better idea of just how badly this affects them. And it causes, after that, basically, we wind up with Trish and Jessica leaving. And they're both somewhat at this point paranoid since they just pulled their punk card on this guy. And on the way out, like, one of the fans approaches Trish and he just wants her autograph, but she's so fucking paranoid that she turns around and attacks the guy and knees him and knocks him down and then sees him on the floor.
Which that scene also features a little bit of an Easter egg. It features one of the original the
comic book. Yeah.
Comic books that Patsy Walker was originally in, which she first debuted in sort of like these, teen romance comic books before she was later inverted be like, oh, she was the assistant of Hank McCoy, who then led her onto a mission with the Avengers and whatever.
Exactly.
Patsy Walker was related to, I can't remember the original person from the 50s, but her last name was Walker too. And they're trying to say that the two characters are one and the same, even though Patsy Walker is a superhero and Walker from the 50 was, you know, just a regular person involved in romance with guys. So
that basically leaves us to Jessica getting back to her office and it's locked because the guys locked it because she didn't pay them, and she just kind of nudges it open with her inconsistent strength and walks right into her office like nothing. Then we get...
She kind of breaks the lock again after got fixed.
And then we get Malcolm getting dragged down the hallway by, what's the other guy's name? The neighbor? The underwear guy? I'm just calling him underwear guy if none of you know the name. Going once, going twice, underwear guy. So then we see Malcolm getting dragged down the street by underwear guy. Yeah.
So he talks about Malcolm being in their kitchen, like we found him in Jessica's kitchen in the first episode. And he kind of drops a bomb like, yeah, you know,
we're all a little racist. He dropped the Hogan bomb.
And it's like, we saw a black person in our apartment and it scared us. And that
terrible.
This isn't Mississippi.
That gives Jessica idea to basically use Malcolm to get the drugs she needs from the hospital. And she takes him there and puts him in a situation where she knows he's going to get in trouble. But in the confusion, she's able to steal the medication she's looking for to try to stop Kilgrave.
Yeah, she winds up pushing him into a cart, like one of the medicine carts, and then just telling everyone that he lunged at her, and it causes enough of a distraction that she's able to get it. Because, you know, like the neighbor told her, if you see someone like Malcolm, you make a snap judgment. So her plan was basically, I'm going to push him onto the ground, cause an incident in the hospital, and while they're distracted dealing with him, I'll steal the anesthesia that I need.
So meanwhile, a police officer shows up at Trish Walker's apartment because he claims that the person that she you know knocked down when he was trying to get an autograph is claiming assault charges against her, and now that she knows that Kilgrave was out there, and she was already a cautious person in the first place. Like, her house is like a fortress, you know. It's like, she has reinforced doors and bulletproof glass and, video monitors to see who's at her front door before she lets them in. And
she had everything but intelligence, because it's like, this guy comes to the door and this scene went on a little bit too long because he's like, do you think you could open the door? I'd like to come in. I can't let you in. You sure? I'm positive. Absolutely positive. Definitely. Can I see your ID? Sure, here's my ID. You definitely look like a cop. Yeah, I sure do. You sure you a cop? Yeah, I'm positive. You sure you won't? It was kind of like, listen, open the fucking door. Don't open the door. But don't eat up screen time like that. It was just a little bit long. And there's another intercom scene with them later. I'm kind of getting a little tired of the intercom. If I have one complaint, there's too much in-between door conversations going on.
Well, he threatened, like, you know, if I come back with a warrant, you'll be more exposed in the press, and that's not going to be good for your image. And he is actually a cop, so, you know, he thought maybe he wasn't a cop and that, you know, it was just pretending. But being that she was a cop, she still was cautious in opening the door, but she didn't know, and she finds out quickly that he's under the influence of Kilgrave, who sent this cop to kill her.
Right. And then they start fighting on the ground. She takes a nasty bump into one of the pain things. And in the meantime, they're struggling on the ground. She has him in a good leg scissors, good ground game. But he lifts her up and tries to, like, bash her out and breaks out of the hold. It was all really crazy. He goes for a choke. And then that's when Jessica Jones comes in and saves her and knocks her from behind. And here's one of the biggest inconsistencies in the entire fight that I've seen. If you guys go back and watch this, you'll see what I'm talking about. But Jessica Jones attacks him, flips him over. And then he has enough time to look at her and then turn back around and proceed to continue to choke Trish. And it was just really awkwardly done in the sense that it was like, there's no way that that would have happened the way that it is. Go look at the way it's shot. She turns around and just, he casually just goes back to choking her. Like McWrestling. Like imagine if somebody like that attacked your wife and then you're in the middle of a fight with him. Now, you're face-to-face fighting him. Can you imagine him getting an opportunity to turn around again, kneel down, and start choking her for the second time?
I would legit have to be standing there, like, neutral and not moving, like, not putting out my hands to block him.
Exactly.
Or anything
position
at all.
Yourself standing in front of this guy. You're facing him. He's facing you. The two of you are looking into each other's eyes. Your wife's unconscious behind him. He's able to turn around, kneel down, and start choking her again? With you standing right there? Like, isn't she a superhero?
He's not.
I mean, I guess if I'm Rousey and the other person is Holmes, then.
Just go back and look at it. I'm saying you don't have to take my word for it, but go back and look at the awkwardness. At
He has tunnel vision and one thing on his mind. Not
right, but Jessica doesn't have tunnel vision. She should be able to have stopped him faster. Like I said, again, go back and look. It looks very awkward.
If she did have tunnel vision, her tunnel vision would be on him.
I blame her for allowing him to get his hands around her a second time.
I just think it was poorly shot. Just
she
my opinion for this scene.
She knows that he's not in control. And, you know, she probably could just snap his neck easily, but, you know,
he
was sent there with the purpose of killing her friend. He's still an innocent.
He is. Like I said, I just find it a little bit weird. It's like, keep in mind that she was able to punch somebody to death, literally. I can punch somebody in the chest once and stop their heart and end their life. But on the other hand, I can't knock somebody out with one punch.
When she did that, there was nothing to make her hold back. Where now, while she's in the control of herself, she's pulling her punches.
But a fighter has a middle ground between I'm not going to hurt you at all and I'm going to end your life. She can't, believe me, like you should be able to knock someone unconscious.
Well, listen, Spider-Man shouldn't be in most of the fights he's in because he's well strong enough to hurt and kill most of the villains he's fighting against.
Yeah, like when Spider-Man's punching you, he's holding back a bit.
He's
right,
really
but could you imagine
back.
Spider-Man rolling around on the floor wrestling with like a cop? Getting thrown, you know what I mean? Like in that situation, or could you imagine Spider-Man, someone getting their hands around the neck of one of someone Spider-Man's trying to save two times? It's not one of those things that's going to happen. You're not going to throw him over a couch and he's going to have to get up and recover. So I just kind of think it's weird how in one scene, it's okay if she's not that strong, but then by the same token, maybe she shouldn't be able to punch someone to death with one punch, like in a different scene. There's a middle between that. If you've ever seen MMA or anything like that, fighters can pull punches, but it'll still hurt. It doesn't have to be, well, I can only not hurt you at all, or I can end your life. If you fought before, which Jessica Jones has, there's enough there for her to just disable someone quicker. That was my only gripe with the third episode, and that's why I think so far it was my least favorite, because the fighting felt a little inconsistent. Sometimes she struggles more than I think she should, is what I guess I'm saying in summary.
She's not in her A game.
Well, I gotta say, honestly, it's called whiskey for me. These three that we're discussing tonight is the best of the three because it really does help further go into what was been set up, but also really get things moving and also further deepenly show Kilgrave's effect in how he's influencing because his influence is reaching far and wide with getting the police to go after.
So
instead of calling it It's Called Whiskey, they should have called it Is It the Whiskey?
So she follows, she convinces the cop that the cop actually got the job done and killed Trish.
Yeah, by quickly giving her the injection of the anesthesia. She screams up at him, "You killed her!" And he looks down thinking the kill's confirmed, and then he runs away.
Yeah, and again, what I love, but again, I think It's Called Whiskey is the best of these three episodes because, again, it's really paying off what was nicely set up in the first two. and really getting it and really letting us get into the show a lot deeper and really exploring the world and how far and where it reaches and such, and also giving us more and more setup as to what exactly happened with Jessica, what did Kilgrave do to her and such. It's fascinating. And also this episode has some nice little comedy thanks to the interaction back and forth of Christian Ritter and Mike Coulter as Jessica and Luke, who I think were absolutely perfect together.
So she then follows the police officer back to Kilgrave so she can confirm that, yes, he is definitely alive, definitely doing all this to her. And then she's put in a situation where Kilgrave, not having any regard for life, now that this cop has, you know, did his mission, you know, he tries to dispose of him by telling him to go walk off a roof, which makes her expose herself to Kilgrave by trying to rescue this cop from jumping off the side of a building. So now that Kilgrave knows that Jessica's there, he uses this family he's been having a control over to help him escape by having them attack Jessica. At the same time, she still has to try to prevent this cop from killing himself. But one of the things they didn't never explain is, like, is the kid still in the closet, or were they ever let out? Are they in there dying or dead or what? Did they ever explain that?
It has to be a spoiler for later. But we do see how some people are still being affected and such later on, a few days after.
Yes, we definitely do.
Kilgrave tells them to go do something.
Yeah. So getting to the latter half of this episode, they finally give us the flashback. We've talked about it throughout the entire podcast, so no secret at this point, but they finally give us the full flashback of Jessica Jones punching Luke Cage's wife and her flying into the street and how the Purple Man played into the entire thing. And all of that nature. She flashbacks to it right when the cop is about to do his whole suicide bit there.
Yeah, and by the Purple Man telling her to murder somebody, that kind of breaks the control he had over her all this time. Not fully, but enough that she's starting to resist because she's done something she knows is wrong, and
it's morally wrong.
Yeah, right. And when she's leaving, going down the steps, she gets attacked by another one of this guy's thugs, and she has a hard time with this guy. He grabs her, he trips her on the floor, she's struggling to get him into the sleeper hold, and you know, that fight, another one that went on a little too long with like a regular human being. I'm gonna just say that maybe it's because she's green right now, and that over time we're gonna start seeing her be a little bit more badass, because you know, there's a lot of vulnerabilities. I guess it's to keep it exciting, though, but she gets into a lot of fights with regular people that are very dangerous. Like, she takes an ass beating on the bed. Remember the guy's, like, has her on top of the bed, and he's like, she has to really struggle and push him away with her feet. You know, again, this is someone, keep in mind, I'm not criticizing her, but this is someone who can punch you dead. Someone came at you with a knife, and you're like underneath him struggling. Like, look like he could rape your ass, which doesn't make sense if a little while ago you were able to punch somebody unconscious. You know, and then another person comes out after that, another one of the Purple Man's thugs, and tackles her and then spears her, like, into a post. And this time, I believe it was a woman. So now a woman is rushing her and spearing her into a post, and then she finally gets
an older woman, too.
It was an older woman. That's what it looked like. It looked like fucking, what's this chick, the talk show lesbian Ellen. It looked like Ellen fucking speared her. God, so I'm thinking to myself, it's like fucking, you're supposed to be, at least have some level of power. I already know you can punch someone dead, but you've been tackled, thrown down steps, you've had to struggle with this one guy who looked like he almost raped you with a knife, and now Ellen speared you into a fucking post. So again, this is just the inconsistency, and I can't tell if she's strong or weak at times. It's weird. Like, she takes as much of an ass beating as she gives to someone who's supposed to be so dangerous.
Oh, no, yeah. Again, Jessica will give as good as she gets.
Yeah, apparently. And that's when she finds the room. There's like a shrine built to her where there's pictures and stuff everywhere. And like,
oh, yeah, which giant... is like...
She does discover that she's been under surveillance for quite a while now. She discovers a lot of pictures of her. It's been taking her just walking around doing it like somebody hired a private investigator to spy on her, you know, and you just
they're taking pictures of her taking pictures.
You see the obsession that Kilgrave has with her.
You know, you can make villains inherently sympathetic or layered of some sorts, but I feel like sometimes, like, once you show that side of someone, it's like, yeah, I they're fucked. No.
Yeah, and what was with her and the dude in the dumpster? Like, the way they fell into the dumpster there, what was that about?
She wanted the cop to believe that he actually went through the process of jumping off the building because he was knocked out. So she got him, and then they, you know, had them jump into the trash, which then woke him up. And he's like, "What happened?" He's like, "Well, you jumped off the side of a building." So now he's
right,
and he did the command he was told to do, which was to jump off the building, which would snap him out of the situation. So now he's starting to realize he's done some stuff that.
Yeah. Well, all she says to him is that we both survived. And that's because
she's learning from the incident with Hope earlier on, where it was just like, I have to make this person believe that they accomplished the task that he set them out to do. Otherwise, they may look like they're fine now. This guy may go back to work 2 days later and then just randomly just walk out of the building or climb up to the top of the police building and just like try to kill himself. So I must make him feel like his task is done in order for him to go about living life regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tells him, go bandage yourself up and forget that this ever happened. And that's when he realizes that he killed someone. And then she tells him that he didn't, you know, and then she says, you're just confused. Like, no one died. Nothing happened. Just, you know, get out of here. Just go home. And then he winds up just sort of leaving a little bit confused. Overall. And then we get to, Luke Cage, who she meets him back at the apartment again.
And she tries to push him away. Cause she feels that if she realizes that through all these pictures are being taken of her, that he's not being surveyed. So now he wants to keep him out of harm's way by pushing him away, and figure that if the Purple Man doesn't know about Luke Cage, then he'll be safe and he won't get hurt because of me.
Yeah, typical Peter Parker mentality. It's like, I want to keep my loved ones far away from me so they're not affected by what's going on. But the one thing that stays with her is that one of the pictures that she sees is her when she was taking pictures from the other fire escape.
So the person's taking pictures of her taking pictures.
Yeah, so she's trying to figure out what the hell angle was this person at. Like, how the hell did they capture her? Who could it be? So she goes to the spot and she's just looking around. She's watching people pass and she's sort of taking in the environment, trying to just figure out exactly where this person will be and how they would get the shots of her. And that's basically where the third episode closes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, overall, I really enjoyed this. I thought that this was very well done.
I'm loving the series.
it's absolutely fantastic at this point.
Yeah, no, it's really, really cool, man. I love the music. I love the atmosphere to it.
Noir might be my absolute favorite genre of anything. And, again, these first three episodes really help set up the lighting, the shadows through windows, the music. It's like, oh, God, so dripping in noir. It's beautiful.
Now, one of the contrasts between this and the Daredevil series, most of what happened in the Daredevil series is at night. It's, like, totally dark. But this takes – a lot of this takes place in the daylight also. So it's
– yeah.
That contrast, it goes back and forth.
Plenty of scenes during the day with it. So it's not all dark. It's not – but it's
dark and gritty without directly being dark all the time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You do see the contrast between when things are really grim and when things aren't grim. And
But what's crazy about it is they managed to make it such a grim world with the lighting and the color. Everything sort of has like a dirtiness over it, like I mentioned before. But it doesn't feel like you wouldn't like to live there. You know what I mean? Like, that would be a cool atmosphere to be a part of.
No fucking way. I don't want to live in Hell's Kitchen.
Coward?
So yeah, it's like, you know, they're in New York, but it's like they're more in the, I guess, the Williamsburg area, if you're familiar with New York.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, it's incredible how, the contrast, is totally there. It's absolutely wonderful in that regard. Because again, with Matt, he's the attorney by day, and rarely will he pull out Daredevil. Like, most times he pulls out Daredevil costume is like any sort of daytime is like, oh, well, it's dusk, you know, sun's about to go down, so I guess I'll head on patrol, you know, Daredevil and whatnot.
Yeah, that's
but with Jessica, she's a private investigator, and sometimes most of her dirty work does take place in the light of day. So it makes sense.
That's another contrast between the two. Like with Daredevil, you're seeing the origin of a person evolving to a vigilante superhero.
Well, Jessica, you're thrown right into the middle of it.
No, it's not that. She's not evolving into becoming a hero. She's just going through life. If she didn't have power, she'd still be going through a lot of messed up situations, you know?
Yeah, it's like her heroing days are done and she's trying to leave it behind her, but she still has to depend on her powers every now and again to help her get through her everyday life.
And her powers have had very little factor into her getting out of her situation more than her detective work. You know, a lot of it has had to do with how smart she is and how informed she is. Very few times has it been because of how strong she is, because she gets her ass whipped a lot. Right. Regular guard. So it's basically been being one step ahead of the game mentally. I do like watching her pull the locks off of things, though. That's my favorite thing.
Yeah, in the hospital. Ting! I was like, I don't know.
That's a recurring thing for Jessica. That's a recurring thing of hers in the comics, and it's a recurring thing of her in the show. It's like,
yeah, it's my favorite thing. Every time I see a door, I get giddy. That's the word, right, Jordan?
You're a private dick. You know how to pick locks, right? Yeah, but fuck it.
Yeah, crank. I don't know. It's just my thing. I wanted to see Jessica Jones break locks forever.
Well, hey, again, that is a thing of Jessica Jones. So if you're a fan, particularly of seeing locks getting broken, by the way, you're one weird person that has a very specific thing they look after for. But hey, whatever floats your boat. This show's for you. You're gonna get all your lock breaking joys out of this. So hey, go for it. Hey, Netflix subscription, that bitch.
Yeah, that's what you gotta do, man. All right. Well, guys, it's been a really good episode. I'm really excited to do more of these. This is such a good series. I'm gonna go watch some more as soon as we're done here. Overall, I've just been blown away. I love it. Very, very artistic, very intense series. Nothing's really captured me this way in a long time, where I just marathon so many episodes, going into episode 8 now. So, again, this has been Mick Wrestling and Rick Dara and Surfer and Jordan Cobb from Talk Brunch and the What Are You Reading comic book show. We're going to be doing a lot more of these, right, guys?
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's going to be fun to go over. And I'm sure it's going to be lots more Netflix Marvel series that are coming out. This is just them. They're going to expand that universe because that's what they've been doing. Hashtag it's all connected, you know? It's going to be a blast.
We're going to sit here and love it all.
Yeah, I had fun with you guys, man. This could be a thing. On that note, we're out of here.
See ya.
Peace.
Good night.